Good morning. Bills focused on access to health care and decreasing violence against women are at the heart of the Women's Legislative Caucus. And this year, they could be even more important. Representative Della Al-Baladi details their priorities. Volunteers around the state are reaching out to Hawaii's homeless people this week, and the training they got to do it was more standardized than in past years. Neighbor Island Continuum of Care Chair Maude Cumming, or former Chair Maude Cumming, gives us a status report on the annual point-in-time count. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Seabury Hall's annual dance festival explores common ground with dancers from all over. And the Maui Ocean Center unveils a new whale-watching program.
It's Friday, January 20th. The conversation starts right after a look at these headlines. Good morning and happy Aloha Friday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Looking at quite an important annual survey.
Exactly. And this year, it may yield even better results. Now, every year about this time, you know, volunteers go out in search of homeless people around our state. The annual point-in-time count is a requirement of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for Hawaii's Continuum of Care. Now, tied to that count is the funding process providing permanent and transitional housing, supportive services, and planning for future outreach. This year, volunteer trainers were more standardized than in past, and organizers hope that the increase of that kind of training will result in greater quality and accuracy of information. Maude Cumming is the executive director of the Family Life Center, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you again. So how has it been going this week on the Neighbor Islands side? There are distinct challenges that the Neighbor Islands have that certainly Oahu doesn't, although there are some similarities.
Yes, you know, because our area is rural, we do have to go out and search. And so this year we kind of changed our strategy. One of the things we did was we just had our areas mapped out by regions. We had six regions. So prior to the count, we took the time to really detail out every street, every beach, every place that we knew that there were potentially homeless, or where actually some of our clients were. So we detailed that out and to hopefully ensure that we covered every area. And then also in the past, we've had duplications. Some people who were in shelters were counted again because they were hanging out. So we've taken the time to, there are two shelters on Maui Family Life Center, one's one, and then Kaleake Ola. So we, on Monday morning, printed out our list, make sure we cross-check them, so that as surveys are coming in, we ensure that those people aren't double-counted. We also have been going out early in the morning, like 6 o'clock in the morning, as well as in the evenings up until 9 at night. And just sometimes we may visit the same area, but at a different time to be sure that we get the most coverage, because quite often we don't find people in the middle of the day. We do find them early in the morning and late at night.
Maude, as you're talking about how the strategy for this year changed, we're also told that the way in which volunteers were trained to, you know, approach someone and talk to them was much more standardized than it was in past across the island, so that the information hopefully would be more consistent and more accurate. How has that been reflected in what your volunteers have been telling you?
Well, on Maui, we don't have a whole lot of volunteers. We're relying primarily on either outreach staff or shelter staff who are already familiar with the process. So we did have probably maybe five or six volunteers, and they were required to come to the training and given the same training that everyone else had. And so we're hoping that that process will yield better results.
With all the challenges, though, that you have, and you detailed some of those just a moment ago, did you need more volunteers than the ones that you got to be able to help the outreach workers so they wouldn't have to take this on as well, or as much of it?
No, actually, I think it's a little different in the rural areas because people are not lined up on the sidewalk, you know, so it requires some knowledge of where to go and how to exactly to know just where people might be. So having volunteers go out on their own, even though they know the process, is a little difficult. So like the Child Project, they're volunteers, and they're already familiar with particular areas, so they've gone out. So I think it's a little different for us.
When you did go out at different times and obviously changing your strategy to see whether or not you could get better information, see who was in different places at different times, did you actually find that that was beneficial, that you yielded more information and that you were able to count more people?
Yes.
And how did they feel? Were they the same people who had been approached at different times in other years, or was this a newer group of people?
You know, it depends where we were. What we found, for example, in the Kihei area, in the first, I've been off island for the last 2 days, so I'm trying to catch up. But in the first 2 days, we found that we did not encounter very many families at all. In fact, probably 90% of the people we encountered in Kihei were single, white, Caucasian males between the ages of, say, 25 and 50.
And
that is what we know, what we have experienced throughout the year, is that different areas will have different populations.
So that wasn't different from, for example, maybe last year or the year before that? I mean, that level of single white male.
It was different. It seems to have increased the proportion of families that it seemed to have increased to more singles.
Which some would say is good news for families that they're receiving care.
Yes.
But when you go now to see how these new people who you are approaching are responding, were they very responsive to this? Were they willing to engage?
They were willing to engage. A lot of them were recent to the area, new to the area, and you know the story of I came here with others, and we were going to find a job, find an apartment, and then found out that the cost of living is high. So maybe one of us will find a place, and we will, because we can't all afford to find a place separately. So it's kind of that story.
The idea that they're, you know, recent to the area is one that's been fueling a lot of, some would say, myths, some would say, you know, truth. But for you, talking about these, you know, recent folks who are trying to do something, even though they're here now and homeless, did anybody just ask them why they didn't go home? I mean, there are programs that would have allowed them to go home, are there not?
Yes. And primarily it's because they feel like they still want to try, they still want to make a go of it, they believe they can, and so they're going to stick it out for a little while.
And these are able-bodied people who, if they had a job and had the wherewithal, they would be able to maintain a quality of life. You're not talking about people who might be put into the chronically homeless category?
No.
So that seems to be very different.
That population seems to have grown.
In other places in the neighbor islands, were there also other changes that you've been able to observe in the short term from what you've heard from outreach workers?
No, I haven't determined any kind of trends or any kind of significant changes. And of course, we'll do a review again today. And we still, what we try to do on Maui is have Family Life Center serves as kind of a the where everyone turns in their surveys, and then we kind of do a make sure deduplicate things before it gets entered into HMIS. So I'm still waiting for all of that to come in.
Well, we're going to look forward to having all of those numbers and see really some of those trends and overall changes, and including the one that you just talked about a moment ago. Thanks so much for giving us your time this morning, and good luck with the rest of the survey.
Thank you. All righty. Bye-bye.
Maud Cumming is the executive director of the Family Life Center on Maui.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a convergence of young dancers on Maui. First, your quiz. Later on in the program, we'll be taking you whale watching with the Maui Ocean Center. So for today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a cetacean that makes its home in Hawaiian waters. It can also be found in oceans around the world, though. Now, cetacea are marine mammals, and the one we're describing is found in temperate and tropical waters. Scientists have identified three distinct groups in Hawaii: an offshore population, a northwestern Hawaiian island group, and a small group around the main Hawaiian islands. That last one is described as unique and genetically distinct from the other populations. This creature is black with a gray throat and neck. The body is slender, and the head is has an impressive array of 44 teeth. They are long and pointed and sharp. Their average size is around 16 feet, with adult males reaching a length of 20 feet and weighing up to 4,900 pounds. We're looking for its name, and if you know your Latin, its scientific name, Sidorca crassidens, might just tip you off. We'll be back with the answer in half hour, but if you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you get it right first, you'll get the prize.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
It's something Seabury Hall Dance Director David Ward has been wanting to do for years, make his school's annual dance festival into an event with national reach, bringing together students of the movement arts in joint performance with other Maui and mainland schools. His Common Ground Dance Festival continues to grow in its second year. It's coming up this weekend, and he's on the line with us now. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning, Chris.
How many kids have you got waiting in the wings? I mean, not figuratively, literally, but you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, no, this year is pretty substantial. We have over 100 young dancers who will be performing this weekend.
What ages?
Well, the youngest are, there's a few middle school kids. Like one of the halau is bringing some younger kids, but mostly they're high school. Age, 9th through 12th grade.
You know, you have such a wide range of dancers for this thing that I sometimes feel that the term movement arts is even more sort of wide-ranging than dance, because it's just getting to be such a broad feel, don't you think?
Well, I like to include the word movement arts because I'm also trying to reach out to, like, for an example, we have a taiko group who will be performing, and
yeah.
they're doing a very movement-based taiko piece.
Uh-huh.
But they're not, you know, they're not trained dancers. They're just, as you know, taiko can be very visual.
Sure.
And sometimes the movement, the choreography between those drums can be spectacular.
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean, you know, the whole idea of barriers breaking down between different sub-genres of an art form.
Well, that's exactly what I'm hoping to do. I wanted to, you know, so often I've been in the dance business, you know, for decades. And one of the things that I always feel is that people kind of stay cloistered in their school's performance or, you know, they go and they see a ballet or a modern program, sometimes a recital show. But to bring all of these things together on one stage, you know, some of these kids would never see some of this stuff otherwise, right? So they're
yeah.
opening their eyes to new things, and the audience gets a taste of such an amazing variety of styles and energy. So I really believe that there is, great benefit for everybody in this kind of a program.
Don't you think that base has sort of, like, say, over the arc of your years teaching dance, don't you think that base has kind of broadened during those last recent decades?
Well, I do. And I think some of it's because of some of the things that we get to see, you know, that's more exposure on television and that sort of thing with, you know, like even with So You Think You Can Dance, for an example, which a lot of my kids like to watch.
Uh-huh.
You know, those kids have to do a variety of stuff. It's not like, okay, you're doing one style. Everybody has to do a little taste of this and a little taste of that. So, yeah, I think it has been more exposed that there's greater opportunity than just one, you know, dance being classical ballet or modern dance, right?
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, everything's possible, and I think there's so many more people dancing than ever.
Really? That's good news. Just drawn to the idea of moving any way that you want to come up with, that kind of thing, David?
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, from just people just doing social dancing,
mm-hmm.
like whether it's swing or, you know, ballroom has had more of a resurgence, just all kinds of things like that. But also just in styles, yeah. I mean, I think that there are more studios are I think have increased in numbers. But I mean, for an example, what we're bringing in right now, like these kids from Portland who are coming from this performing art high school, Dance West. You know, there are 18 of them that have flown in from there.
Mm-hmm.
But their school has over 200 plus students who are just in the dance pro segment of that. It's a small public high school, geared toward the performing arts,
mm-hmm.
and you know it's just bursting at the seams. You know they can barely fit kids in all the studios. And that is super exciting.
Well, it's also exciting to see how many kids are feeling that creative urge, no matter what direction it takes them. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, they may or may not pursue a life of dance, but you know that. Even in education, when kids are learning about creativity, it makes them creative thinkers. They're generally helps them improve their academic skills. You know, it just when kids are able to release and experience, you know, that kind of passion and creativity, I think it just makes them better at everything else in their lives. Whether they ever pursue dance or they just become a patron of dance in the future.
Well, you know, anything that requires that kind of level of skill, levels of skill that can only be attained through really diligent practice, it kind of teaches you the value of hard work, to use a pretty corny phrase.
Well, that's absolutely right. Dance, like any sort of, you know, whether it's martial arts or dance, I mean, you don't improve unless you're practicing.
Yeah.
If you're playing an instrument, you're not going to get better if you don't practice every day. And, like, you know, that is absolutely correct. It teaches them, if I want to be the best at what I do, I have to be committed. I have to be there. I have to be in class, be in rehearsal. These dancers have been here this week, these dancers from Portland, working with my dancers here. I have, there's 18 of them and 15 of my kids working on a piece together that they're going to perform. you know, they did it in 7 days, every day, for about 5 hours a day. So on top of school, on top of homework, on top of everything, every day they've been in rehearsal, just working like crazy. And I tell you, it's for all, as hard as producing something like this is, my heart is so satisfied when I see the magic that happens between these kids who have never met before, working so hard, and now they're going to bring this amazing piece to life. And then, of course, the connections they're making with each other, the friendships that will hopefully last a lifetime. It's so satisfying. It makes all the work worth it.
Well, you know, David, you can set the framework, but you can't supply the kids with energy if they don't have it, right?
Well, yes, to some degree that's true. But if you bring energy and you bring excitement, it is it's contagious, right? It's infectious.
Sure.
So if you bring that and you get these kids turned on, then yes, once they're with you, you know, you can take them anywhere. I mean, you can really just explore boundless possibilities.
I would think one of the great rewards would be at what you were describing earlier, seeing how they support one another once that energy has been kind of unleashed.
Oh, I got to tell you, I'm watching these rehearsals with our guest artists. I'm sitting here in the studio, and it's just touching me so deeply to see. You know, you never know. Are these kids going to connect? Are they going to be, you know, is there going to be tension between them? Are they going to feel intimidated by each other? But no, oh my God, they're working so harmoniously and with such generosity with each other. It's pretty unbelievable. It's pretty amazing.
Sounds pretty rewarding. Thanks so much, David. Good luck with the
show. Thank you so much, Chris. I really
David Ward is the dance director at Seabury Hall and the director of the second annual Common Ground Dance Festival, performed by a collective of Maui's youth-based movement arts programs in concert with the Seabury Dance Program, this Saturday and Sunday at 3 p.m. at Seabury Hall's A'ali'i Kuhunoua Honua Creative Arts Center in Makawao.
Supporters of the Honolulu plastic bag ban say a bill to strengthen it is languishing in the city council. Worse, they say, there's no data about the impact of the current ban. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Okay, so we've had this plastic bag ban in effect in Honolulu for about 18 months now, since July 1st, 2015. And in all this time, really, we don't have any data to suggest that it's creating a positive impact?
None conducted by the city, Anita Hofschneider found out, our reporter. There is a State Department of Transportation study that did find that reducing those bag usage meant less waste into our waterways, but no, nothing from the city specifically. This is in contrast to Kauai County, Hawaii Island, Maui, where they have seen some evidence of bans that are more strict than Oahu's, actually having some success keeping bags out of our environment.
So the bill that would, in effect, bring us perhaps to that level is just sitting on the shelf at the city council? I mean, wasn't Brandon Elefante the one to introduce that last October?
Yeah, so it's been a couple months now. There's even testimony on the bill, but Carol Fukunaga, who runs the committee to hear that bill, has not scheduled it, told Anita she hasn't heard much about it, said she's been busy with other things like sewers and rail infrastructure. But the bill that Elefante has introduced is modeled on the ones on the neighbor islands, which have a higher threshold of thickness of bags. You know, a lot of people were confused on Oahu when they went into Long's or maybe ABC after the ban went in place, and yet you have these plastic bags, thicker plastic bags.
Those big yellow ones.
Yeah, and they're widely available, and you just kind of scratch your head and go, wait a minute, I thought we had a ban in place here. So the idea from Elefante is to have a stronger legislation. I should tell you, of course, that retailers strongly oppose this. They oppose the previous ban. They say it's going to only add to the high cost of living, or excuse me, high cost of business.
Which would be really interesting to find out whether or not that has in fact happened and get some data, you know, on their end too. But with these thicker plastic bags that many of us have seen and may even have in our homes, aren't those supposed to be even more dangerous for the environment?
Yeah, I mean, we're still using plastic. These things are hard to, well, they last for a long time. They go into the ocean. They affect marine mammals. That's something the Surf Rider Foundation is concerned about. You know, what we might do is look to what California did. They actually banned the bags flat out. And then if you use a paper bag or a reusable bag that's provided by stores, they charge 10 cents. Some say that's the way to go. And, of course, California is often very progressive in these sorts of things.
And would there be any movement in that direction aside from the bill that Elefante has? Anything new coming down?
Yeah, I haven't heard any talk about that. There's nothing before the legislature right now. You know, the plastics industry is very powerful. They've lobbied nationally a number of states to try and oppose any effort to ban. They're here as well. They have lobbied and gave money to lawmakers to try and have their say.
And I can remember, and perhaps you do too, that in 2013, we tried to have a ban. I mean, there were those who were out there actively doing that to see whether or not we would be consistent with, have everything be as a total ban. And that didn't go anywhere in the legislature.
No, it sure didn't. By the way, I just, on a personal note, I use canvas bags. I have five of them. They're very strong. You can wash them. And I always ask the clerks, how many people do this? And they say, hardly anyone. They prefer the plastic. And that's a hard thing to change, a hard habit to change.
Well, me too. And I guess we'll be using those this weekend when we go shopping. Thanks, Chad. Talk to you Monday.
Bye-bye.
Chad Blair joins us with Reality Checks Every Day. Now, after a look at world news, we're going to take a look at our world right here in Hawaii and what our news department is working on for next week. And to help us do that, news director Bill Dorman joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Good to see you. You know,
you too. We got the Hokulea coming home.
The Hokulea. You know, Sam Gunn just in on the conversation talking with Chris just the other day. And as he mentioned, he's joining the next leg of this. We know they've made their way through the Panama Canal, heading back to the Pacific, to the Galapagos, among other places. But while most of us won't be able to be like Sam and join the voyage, we'll get an update in terms of hearing from them how they're doing as they make their way back home.
And for next week, too, we have someone else who is traveling, someone who is now going to be very important in our conversations, Mad Dog.
Yeah, James Mattis, traveling the Pacific. It's going to be his first overseas trip in office as defense secretary, and he's heading to Asia. South Korea first, and then Japan. Two stops, obviously very important in terms of U.S. troops, for one thing, being based there. You have nearly 30,000 in South Korea. You have more than 50,000 in Japan. Donald Trump, one of the things he said on the campaign trail was, oh, maybe the host countries need to pay more in support for these.
Pull their weight.
Yes. So this is going to be among the topics. One of the things that we're going to do next week, though, is from a perspective, look at how this is playing in those countries. Not so much in terms of our media here and covering the defense secretary, but how's this playing in South Korea and Japan, and what the local media there are looking at in terms of this story.
Scratching their heads and wondering about all the uncertainty that the rest of us are talking about, no doubt.
Uncertainty is a word for sure.
We're also going to have some arts and culture and focusing on Barry Lopez, I understand.
Yeah, Barry Lopez, who I know that Chris is going to be talking to as well, but he writes about a relationship with the environment. He's been on Kauai for a couple of weeks, and he'll be giving a free talk at the Art Auditorium on Wednesday. As a storyteller himself, he said that everything is held together with stories and compassion. And Noe Tanigawa is going to be talking to him about that. He won the National Book Award for Arctic Dreams. It's a conversation about nature, people, and what he calls a recovery of a sense of reverence for life. So that should be good.
Well, a good maxim for life, too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anything else that we need to talk about that's coming out?
Special Kind of Dress.
I forgot about that
one. Local favorite, they say. It's making a bit of a comeback.
Oh.
So just to be aware, Molly Sala's going to have
closet.
All the details. Well, there are some things to listen for on this.
All right,
I'll just leave it at that.
All right, well, maybe she can convince me then. All right, we'll I know see. There are some new designs and some things that we're going to make it maybe a little more attractive to a younger audience.
You bet.
Thanks, Bill. Bill Dorman joins us every Friday with a look at coming attractions from our news department.
This week, California Governor Jerry Brown had some harsh words for climate skeptics.
We can't fall back and give in to the climate deniers. The science is clear. The danger is real.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we sit down with Governor Brown for a state's eye view of science, how states can lead on issues like climate change and clean energy with or without Washington. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation. Support for today's programming comes from the annual BIA Home Building and Remodeling Show, today through Sunday at the Blaisdell, featuring new products and services, building trends, and remodeling techniques. BIAHawaii.org.
And it being Friday, one of the other things that we do is take a look at our email bag and what has been posted on Facebook. So here's our first one that came in response to a backyard quiz about Reverend Akaka.
Justin Hahn of Honolulu said, quote, "Meanwhile, in Hawaii, Kamehameha Schools, OHA, and dozens of other institutions work to create a Native Hawaiian-only space in order to defend federal grants."
Antonio Gimbernat of Kahului wrote in, following Chris Lee's proposal about a bill to force disclosure of tax returns for presidential candidates. He said, "Trump's business is none of my business until he becomes president. Anything he has done before becoming president is also none of my business. I just hope he does a good job as president. This is just a weak attempt to harass Trump, similar to how the public demanded to see Obama's birth certificate. Once it was released, what happened? Nothing. Same with Trump's tax returns. So why the fuss? It's stupid."
After our story on the possibility of tax hikes in 2017, Robert B. said, "Government's answer to poor planning and bordering on criminal malfeasance is just reach into the pockets of citizens again. What citizen can just turn out their pockets for more?"
And following Tuesday's report on Wallet Hub's rating Hawaii the fifth worst state in the country in which to retire, Elizabeth Jenkins from Na'alehu wrote in, "I have to totally disagree with Wallet Hub's survey. It rated New York number one for quality of life. That's crazy."
And thanks for the feedback. Just a reminder, on February 14th, the conversation moves to 11 a.m. on HPR 1. But if you have something to tell us, our talkback line is 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Every session, the Hawaii Women's Legislative Caucus releases a package of bills reflecting their priorities. And while that happened again this week, the concern over the disconnect from presidential support over the status of women is bringing greater local emphasis. Access to health care, stemming domestic violence, plus the safety and well-being of children and families are at the root of this season's package. Representative Della Albalotti is co-chair of the Women's Legislative Caucus. She joins us now to put this year's bills in context. And generally speaking, I mean, here we are not even a week after the march that drew thousands to the Capitol and many more around the state. Della Albalotti, are we really looking at a time when focus on women and the well-being of children and families has to be brought into greater spotlight?
It definitely has to be brought into greater spotlight, Beth Ann. We've been working over the last 20 years as a caucus, but I think we are more empowered and encouraged by the attention that's being brought to women's issues. We will continue to fight in these areas of healthcare, ensuring children health and safety, reducing violence against women, and ensuring economic opportunity.
So let's talk about some of those bills. Some of them are new. Some of them stem from issues we've been talking about for a while. Some from the last year or so. But this one, relating to limited service for pregnancy centers, requiring that those centers disclose the availability of an enrollment information for reproductive health services, that seems to be a little newer.
It is a new bill, and what we've discovered is that there are these limited service pregnancy centers out there where women are going to get counseling, but they're not given the full range of information. They're not being informed about the publicly funded options that they have available. And so we're talking about people, women, getting full disclosure of the options that they have in front of them when they're facing the difficult decision of maintaining a pregnancy.
Some would call these fake centers. Is that what we're talking about?
We are. They're limited service pregnancy centers. And what we really want is just transparency and disclosure of information, medically sound information.
Another new bill for this year is allowing same-sex couples to be able to have the same access to insurance coverage for in vitro fertilization. Why this bill now?
This bill is important because We want to make sure that it's non-discriminatory. Hawaii has actually been a leader in vitro fertilization. We've had this mandate for over 20, 30 years. But what we wanted to make sure is that same-sex couples also have that one-shot chance at being able to create their families.
For some of the issues that you've been following for a while concerning sexual violence, rape kits, those issues continue in various bills this time around, too. For the last one, looking at what happens with the collection of the rape kits and how are they tested and what is the AG's responsibility going forward?
So the Women's Legislative Caucus has been a leader on this. Representative Ichiyama, Senator Thielen, Senator Roz Baker. We've been watching and monitoring this, working with attorney generals, and we want to make sure that they have criteria for the testing of the backlog. And we also want to make sure that they keep moving forward on this issue because every untested kit is a person. We have to remember that.
And for kids who are in dangerous situations and they are too young to even know they are in a dangerous situation because they are in child care. We've heard about children who unfortunately died, babies who died because the child care center didn't have appropriately trained people, perhaps, or for whatever reason, looking at what kind of real, you know, regulation will be put up for that comes right out of these news headlines.
Absolutely. And the caucus has always been focused on health and safety of children. But this year, it's really crystallized. We have a number of bills looking at child care facilities. We also have a bill called Hawaii Keiki Healthy and Ready to Learn. And that's going to be looking at how do we strengthen health-related services that are given and provided through the educational system. So really a focus on the well-being and safety of children.
We've talked about family leave for a very long time, and it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of traction nationally, although we keep talking about it and talking about it. Same thing, I would suppose, has to do with the parity for women in pay. There are those who say, well, you keep talking about it. Well, sooner or later, that wall is going to get knocked down while we talk about walls for other things. How is this going to happen this year when it hasn't been able to get traction in past?
Well, I'm trying to be an optimist, and maybe this is one place where we can build bridges with the new president because he has said that paid family leave is a priority of his and his daughters. But here in this state, we've actually have the opportunity to really study our market and understand what benefit will work. So the Department of Labor, Department of Human Services, the Status on the Commission of Women have acquired a grant that's going to allow us to study that. There are still bills that will be considered within the legislature, but I think this is a kind of benefit that we have to study. So this is the one that the caucus is long supported, but we're actually at a point now where people are looking at it really seriously. So I am optimistic.
While we're talking about family and unpaid leave, there's also the issue of the tax credit and whether or not that credit will be capped at 10% of the federal earned income tax credit.
The earned income tax credit, we're calling it now the working family tax credit. It is one of the best-known anti-poverty measures that we can adopt. But that conversation is going to actually be tied into conversations about rail tax, about all the kind of taxes that we're looking at. So certainly that's going to be something that we're going to talk about, but it's tied up with other big budget items.
And we're still looking at equal pay, and yet there's another bill this year, too.
So with this bill, we're actually paring it down, and we really want to focus on ensuring that people are not retaliated against if they share their salaries. So it's not the full equal pay statute.
Nell Albalati, of all these bills, if you had to pick one that if we talk to each other in May, as we will, that you had to say is an absolute must or a couple of them? I know that's hard. It's like picking your favorite kid.
Oh, that is so hard. But I would say the limited service pregnancy centers, the IVF mandate, the sex assault kit tracking, as well as the child care facility bills.
All right. Well, we'll be talking during session. And thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Representative Della Albalati is a civil rights attorney, wife, and mom. She represents the 24th District, Makiki, Tanlis, Papakolea, Makaulay, Pava'a. You say it for me.
Pava'a.
Pava'a. There, I got it right finally. Manoa. And she's also co-chair of the Women's Legislative Caucus.
Aloha, I'm Gil Riviere. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about a large marine mammal that lives in Hawaiian waters and grows to 20 feet in length. It's gray and black in color and is reported to have three distinct populations around the islands, one that lives offshore, one in the northwest Hawaiian islands, and one small and locally unique group around the main islands. Its dorsal fin is described as sickle-shaped, and its flippers are narrow and pointed. It's often mistaken for another member of the cetacean family with whom it shares a distinctive trait. It attacks and kills other cetaceans. One of them was mated with a bottlenose dolphin back in 1985 to produce a hybrid creature known as a wolfin. And as we told you, its Latin name will give you a clue. Pseudorca crassidens is a scientific name for the false killer whale, and that's today's answer. If you have a quiz idea for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
No one who has seen humpback whales breaching in waters off Maui will ever forget it. Some 10,000 humpbacks make their way to the Hawaiian Islands Humpback Whale National Marine Sanctuary. At this time of year, the Maui Ocean Center is offering whale watch experience tours through the sanctuary, and Lily Solano, head naturalist at the center, is on the line to tell us about them. Good morning, Lily.
Good morning, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Your career has kind of given you the chance to immerse yourself in the behavior of one of the world's most amazing creatures, hasn't it?
It really has. I think every winter we really look forward to having the humpback whales return to the Hawaiian Islands.
I'm not sure, you know, they're considered to be pretty abundant now, right? They're in good shape as far as their survival as a species?
They are. The numbers worldwide actually have increased, so population is fairly stable, which is great.
Yeah, because usually when you hear about animals that are endangered, it only goes in one direction. That's not a good one. But at one time, they were critically endangered. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. And so over the last few decades now, actually, they have increased, and it is definitely a successful story for the humpback whales.
So the whole idea of species being restored, it works, right, when you apply yourself?
Yes.
Well, that's good.
It definitely works.
That's good to hear. What can people expect to see on a tour these days off Maui?
So with peak season actually nearing, that's coming February and March, you start seeing a lot of behavioral activity at the surface, which is pretty pretty amazing. This is an interaction between mother and calf, typically. And mm-hmm. so because the calf can't hold its breath for a very long time, there's a lot of acrobatic behaviors or displays. So you have things like tail slaps and blows, and blows are relatively loud, which is pretty amazing. And probably the most spectacular one is the breeches of the humpback whales.
So they have a specific purpose in terms of just, what, teaching the young how and when to breathe?
Yeah. So when a female gives birth to a calf, she actually will go underneath the calf and guides the calf towards the surface mm-hmm. in order to breathe. And then as the calf continues to grow, the female will actually start teaching the calf all of these behaviors up at the surface. We don't really know exactly why they do most of these behaviors. It's believed that it's a form of communication, but sometimes with the younger humpback whales, it's definitely some sort of fun out there.
You really can't escape the idea that it's play, can you?
You can't. No. When you see them doing it continuously, you know that they have to be having some fun out there.
Well, I would hope that, you know, I think we have a hope for all animals that they get an opportunity to have some fun and not just struggle to survive, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That would include ourselves, I would think, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, fun is important.
Well, Lily, I'm sort of fascinated by the idea of what is not yet known, because you mentioned that some things may be forms of communication, but there's a great deal we have yet to learn about these, isn't there?
There is. I think here in Hawaii, the most spectacular one is the singing of the humpback whales.
Yeah.
So that is still such a huge mystery as far as why are these animals singing. We do know that it's just the males that sing. Mm-hmm. For a long time, it was believed that the males were singing in order to attract a female, but there's actually been no documentation of a female approaching a singing male. So it's, in most cases, it's actually another male that joins a singing male.
So that would, because usually vocalizations of any species are about a few specific things, most usually things like mating displays, right?
Correct, yeah. So that is, you know, no idea why that's going on. It is a beautiful sound, though, that the humpback whales are producing.
Again, leading one to at least want to speculate that they're doing some things just for the heck of it.
Right, exactly. And that's also a very valid theory. Sometimes you have multiple males that are just singing, and I mean, these songs are heard from very long distances, which is pretty amazing.
Well, because I know for example, in dolphin studies, they've found a lot of, I guess what you call behavioral nuances, that they really have distinct personalities, that they choose, which other creatures they spend their time with, that they're capable of really specific behavior from one animal to the other. That seems to be what's happening with our understanding of humpbacks. Is that accurate?
Right. Yeah. No, absolutely. Why is it that one specific male is approaching another? Is that song attracting that male? And it might be a form of communication amongst the animals. Definitely.
Well, it would certainly, I mean, just a layman's speculation would certainly lead you to think that. But how do you get about sort of nailing down if it is communication? How would one establish that scientifically?
So we have, over the years, there's been lots of research about first recording the songs. What sort of sounds are they repeating over and over? And it's actually known that amongst the same population of humpback whales, they're singing the same song that evolves over time. So that's very unique to certain populations. But as far as what really is happening, it's really just about the interaction. So when we see a male that's singing, what are we seeing after? And you typically would assume that a female would approach that to attract them, but that's not the case.
Yeah.
It's actually usually another male.
Well, this is a mystery. It's going to be fun to...
Yeah, absolutely.
...really keep track of. And they also, in terms of their migratory patterns that bring them to Hawaii, they range incredibly far over the earth, don't they?
They do. So here in Hawaii, we're typically getting the whales that are found in the North Pacific. So that's towards the Gulf of Alaska. So most of our population is coming from there. And that alone is about a 3,000-mile journey from that North Pacific area.
Do you ever get tired of seeing them, Lily?
No, absolutely not. It is always a joy. Every single time we're out there, we get to see different behaviors. I think for me, the mother and calf interaction is probably my favorite.
Sure. Lily, thanks so much for talking with us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Chris, for having me.
I think a lot of people envy you your job, right?
It is a very unique opportunity that I get to do, definitely.
Lily Solano is the head naturalist of the Education Department at the Maui Ocean Center, whose aquarium and whale watch experience launched on Tuesday, January 10th.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, currently raising funds for a new kidney resource center in Kapolei and for the Senator Daniel K. Akaka Community Center, kidneyhi.org.
What does the public in Hawaii Public Radio mean? It means we're available to everyone and free of commercial influences. It means reporting to help you be a more informed decision maker, whether it's political hearings of national importance, in-depth coverage of events here and abroad, interviews that provide insight and context. Your financial support puts all of that on the air. If you're already an HPR member, mahalo. If you're yet to contribute to make this important public service possible, please go to our website today and thank you.
Beth Ann, when you hear about the Women's Caucus priorities for this year at the legislature, you have to wonder about the vast differences between that and the direction that the national government is taking.
Which is precisely the reason why it may take on added meaning and emphasis this year.
Sure. Well, it certainly is, if you're looking for examples of a polarized nation, you don't have to look too much further, do you?
I don't think we have to look very far on many issues, particularly in this state as we look back toward Washington.
It's what we call low-hanging fruit in the news business, right?
Well, that low-hanging fruit, I mean, it may be an expression, and we talk about that, and we laugh ruefully in some cases, but those are issues that Hawaii feels deeply about when you look at it over time and hearing from lawmakers who say that, you know, our values and things that Hawaii has worked very hard to ensure will be of those that may, in fact, become a beacon for the rest of the country.
And, you know, I use that term facetiously, but often the stories that are reported so often in the news are they're reported that way because they're the most important ones, right?
Exactly. And we'll have more to talk about with you next week. Now, you know, there's more than talk about turning the zipper lane into a toll road. We'll talk with Representative Greg Takeyama next week with the reasons that he thinks his bill brings better action to standstill traffic.
And a gallery show at the East-West Center on the changing face of Myanmar.
Meanwhile, we always like to hear from you, and you can get to us on our talkback line. Leave us your comments in your own voice. Please leave us your name and the town from which you're calling. Our number is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
The music you hear on the show or the conversations you hear here can be heard in podcast form on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, that's also where you can listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
And I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you next week.